Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we're about to have a conversation with a man who's been in the studio before for his books and other things, Dr. Lawrence Jackson, who is a professor at Emory University and grew up here in Baltimore. He's the teacher of African-American Studies at Emory. He's got a biography of Chester Himes coming out in the coming year, and has been in the show for his other books. He's contributed to Harper's. And this issue, he wrote this piece called The City That Bleeds, Freddie Gray and the Makings of an American Uprising. And Larry, welcome. Good to have you back in the studio, man.
Mark, thanks so much for having me. And I just wanted to share some news with you. I have accepted a position at Johns Hopkins.
Oh, you did?
I will be coming in July,
yes,
as the Bloomberg Distinguished Professor.
And give it up. Yes.
I'm very excited about that. But
That's very cool.
I wanted to share something with the audience, and it was really relevant to the last few moments of the panel that you just had. So
if you
bear with me, I'm
just going to play
something.
We could actually give them the producers to download. We had a big...
Something has happened since y'all... I'm getting like my mom now. Something has happened since y'all have touched it. See, I give it to the young people. And
let them come back with it and then we can do it, because... okay. So we can keep messing with it and see if we can get that on. But what were you going to try to show us?
Well, we were talking about the witnesses to the arrest of Freddie Gray, and I brought students from Emory to. Oh, here we go. Thank you so much. Thank you.
On the morning of the 12th, I was laying in my bed. It was on a Sunday morning. Somewhere between 25 after 8 and 8:30, I was surfing the channels trying to get one of the gospel programs on. And I heard this young man hollering, screaming, "Let me go. I haven't done anything." And that was down here, down the street a little ways. "Why are you grabbing me?" And they threw him to the ground. And I heard him say, "Get your knee out my back. You're hurting my back. You're hurting my back. I can't breathe. I have asthma. Help, please. Somebody help me." And then it was quiet for a moment, and they brought him up the street, and it sounded a little closer to me. So I guess it was across the street from me at that point. And police cars pulled up in front of my door. Two got out the first car, one out the second. And they all run across the street to hear the keys jingling. And he immediately said, "Throw him on the ground." And they put him on the ground, and he was hollering, "Please, somebody help me." And the police told him, "Shut the F up." And they handcuffed him or something over there. And I shook my wife and woke her up, and she said, "Ooh, baby, they dragging him to the van." And he couldn't walk. They were literally dragging him to that van and put him in that van. So they keep saying whatever happened to him in that van. I don't think so. I think it happened right there where those police first initially grabbed him.
So that's an eyewitness to Freddie Gray's arrest.
Did you tape that?
I just had a brief interview with a gentleman from Presbury Street in December when I brought students to Baltimore from Emory University in Atlanta.
Right.
And we were with Brother Lou Fields at the time.
Yes.
Brother Lou was taking us around different places in Sandtown, but then especially we stopped, of course, for a lengthy visit to Gilmore Homes and also to see some of the murals and the attempts of the community to recover from a horrific act of violence. But, anyway, I just was listening to the conversation before, and it seems to me that there were many witnesses, and perhaps these testimonies may be collected or could be collected at a further time, future time. Thanks again so much for having me. As you know, Mark, the piece is just – it's a reflection. It's an outpouring of sadness and melancholy. It's a reflection of my own life, the life of my family, who migrated to Baltimore in the 1930s, I guess, 1920s and 1930s, from the rural South, from the tobacco country in rural Virginia, Southside Virginia, and who came up and who worked in service, who worked for the steel mill, who worked in service to everybody who doesn't know means, you work for a white family, you live in domestic help for a white family. And really were happy to see their lives progress in the time at the time of the Depression, and then of course time of the Second World War. But since then, you know, we have seen really just sort of I think strong reversals. And the article had a couple conversations with some really generous older people. My advice to all the young people is to get under the wing and sit at the feet of as many older people as you can. I know that the name of Dr. John Henry Clark has been raised in this building. I'm on Morgan State University. It's been raised many times, and I you know, benefited, had the wonderful experience of being able to sit at the feet of Dr. Clark and to get some of his wisdom and the long story of the struggle of black people in the United States. But I had the chance to talk to people, and they said, well, Larry, you know, make sure that you look at this 1966 circuit court case, and you can see it fascinatingly, right? Most of us would say that, you know, the mid-60s were really tough times. And Mark, I know we've had some great conversations about some of your work started in that at that moment, some of your power work, you know, especially on the campus of City College, man. You know, I love you, man. But it's fascinating to note that the courts were so reflective and fair in some of their judgments then, and thought that poor black people needed to have faith and confidence in the government and in judicial decisions, and we seem to be, you know, really in another place. The situation, of course, is magnified by the fact that you have six officers charged, four of them African-American, and, I must admit, haven't made up my mind, or, you know, my thoughts are still at ends about the decision yesterday. But I certainly at one point very much did think that there would be just African-American police officers sacrificed basically to, you know, sort of appease the calls for justice, which were completely legitimate. But that in a way, the chromatic setup would be the same, and that we would not really have the people that initiated the stop or the people who were in the supervisory capacity at the arrest would be charged with a crime or would be sort of facing the severity of the judicial system. And, you know, I sort of go through in the article, Mark, and as I said, it's like it's a melancholy, kind of a sad thing. I mean, I talk about my own life. You know, I came from a household with two hardworking parents. My father was for many years as director of the Druid Hill branch of the YMCA. So I knew that neighborhood from, you know, going to the Y, participating in Y summer programs, going to the jazz events that would be there in Sandtown. And remember when Shake and Bake opened, and I went to church at St. James on Lafayette and Arlington, and, you know, knew the neighborhood from the things that we would do at the church. And, you know, church, of course, was Saturday and Sunday and other days of the week and, you know, all of that. But, I too, I think somebody already mentioned it. I mean, I too, or one of the callers mentioned it. I too have had experiences of brutalization from the Baltimore police. And I believe, of course, that I was completely innocent, been sort of stopped by the police and threatened with my life and, you know, threatened with punishment or fines or, you know, being taken to court and so on and so forth. And the over policing or the sort of the rough policing, I mean, that is a tradition of this city. It's not, I mean, you can't even call it a longstanding tradition. I mean, it's something that dates back to the era of Frederick Douglass. I mean, you know, it's something that was in the antebellum, it's in the postbellum, that's what I said. That's why my melancholy and sadness, you know, sort of comes out in the piece. So, and then get to your question, but just I felt like one of the finest things that any elected official that I know of has done took place during the uprising unrest, and that was the reluctance to use overwhelming police force against, basically seemed to me like African-American teenagers, young adults, and the national outcry is that, I'm thinking of some of the words of a prominent presidential hopeful. The national outcry is that, you know, it needs to be more punitive, that the police need to show the mailed fist. I just think that that's so absolutely wrong that, again, I think it's already sort of been articulated, but that we tend to turn to the most vulnerable in our society. The people actually have the least of the public services, the least of the educational and health services, and then we want them to do the most suffering. And then, of course, you know, we also want them to employ us in jobs as police officers and social workers and so on and so forth. So I really was delighted to have the opportunity to spend a little bit of time at the high school run by Nakia Rowe and a group of very committed and talented professionals, and to be able to speak with some of the young people. And the young people are dealing with traumas that I'm a 48-year-old adult that we struggle to deal with as adults with maximum resources. Young people are facing this stuff every day. They're facing hunger, poverty, the trauma of a family collapse, incarceration of adults who they need to have in their lives, being moved from one section of the city to the other, one school to the other. And, you know, some of them are actually managing to get through, be reflective, turn into powerful young people planning on future. And I feel like the national conversation was about giving up on them as if they had somehow created the situation that they were born into. It just seems absolutely astounding to me, which is why I keep trying to bring up in the piece that these are the conditions that I remember. Now everybody says, I mean, Brother Ta-Nehisi Coates will say, well, it's the Ready Rock, you know, that sort of came out in the late 80s. It really changed things. You know, when my partners and I, in our section of town, we lived in Northwest Baltimore, and, you know, we used to always joke with one another because the stuff was coming through in the Sun papers in the early 80s that all these 15-year-old black men were being killed. And we said, man, if we can get to 19, you know, then we're straight. We made it. You know, we can have plan on the future, that sort of thing. And it was tongue-in-cheek, and we were joking, but we couldn't get over what was going on in the early 80s. Mark, we're talking about 30 years, 40 years, where you have typically had a homicide rate in the range of about 300 people killed per year, tends to be 85-90% of them African-American, and God knows how many people have been shot. I mean, you know, you're talking about tens of thousands of people who have been shot. You know, I can remember being with my homeboys being shot at in a car, and that's the most terrifying thing or single thing that stands out to me, you know, when I sort of think of, man, I'm happy I made it through that. We are dealing with young people. This is the basis of their lived experience, and we're not addressing any of their needs. I mean, we're acting as if it's okay, or well, they just got to suck that up, or somehow they will triumph in the end. I mean, I just feel like we need to the humanism word has come up about several times. So, we need to be inspired humanist at this time, and again, not so much with the idea that we're going to enrich ourselves or luxuriate or bask in the media spotlight, but that, you know, we need to help people who desperately need help, and anyone can figure it out. You know, it's not it is rocket science, but it is apparent what needs to be done.
So, and folks, we're here with Dr. Lawrence Jackson, who will soon be coming to Johns Hopkins University. You can join us here at 410-319-8888. And Larry's written this piece we're going to talk about here in Harper's. And you wrote this piece, really interesting. You went into the court watching the trial, and you were there when the family was there and watched their uncle be carried out because he was murmuring and they didn't want him murmuring. Mm-hmm. But the interesting piece was the people who carried him out, the sheriff's deputies, were people that you grew up with, right?
Yeah.
So you write this piece. You say, so you look at that, and you also look at the relationship that one had around in Freddie Gray's neighborhood as well. And you write that you all left at your chance meeting. And you said, you wrote, what united us was the same thing that tied us to Freddie. With other friends of mine who had coached in football, to Porter, who grew up in West Baltimore down the street from my closest friend. Odavi's symbolic theater, the man who was brought out of the courtroom, emboldened a point, a living tissue connecting the litter, the litterers, and the cleaners. Mm. So that intersection and that speaks to what you alluded to earlier when you talked about three of the six police officers are black, and Goodson had the most severe charges. It was black.
Four to six. Mm-hmm.
I think it's three, isn't it?
I thought it was four.
Okay, but anyway, so that's a really interesting frame of mind that you put here.
Of course, this is the overwhelming irony of the piece, and you know, they were all linked. Of course, you know, the emphasis that I had was on the black side of it. I think that the white side hopefully will be brought in by other writers. I'm also reminded of some of the really remarkable work that's come out recently. I was very proud of the piece that Ron Cassie had in Baltimore Magazine. Maybe mm-hmm. you all have had him on the program. I was asked to take a look at the trial and to think about the city, you know, sort of from the point of view of, you know, sort of the unfolding theater of criminal justice. But that was the moment when Brother Odabe, you know, sort of came into the to the courtroom and refused to be silenced. I thought that was very, very symbolic and important. He refused to be silenced, and he had a truth that he wanted to say to his family and to, you know, and again, other people who were around. And I also said in a piece that he reminded me physically so much of a, there's a famous Peel portrait of a historic black Marylander who was a Muslim, you know, sort of captured, brought into slavery
Mahmoud.
In the 18th century. And I would like for us to also keep some of these ties in mind, that the ties are transatlantic, that the ties are global, that the ties are diasporic, that this is something that needs to be addressed, or, you know, if we're looking for serious solutions, it also needs to be addressed in that way. I mean, with a total sense of a holistic address. But then after, you know, I'd sort of looked at the situation and thought of the sheriff's deputies as, you know, being, you know, more or less the villains in the situation. And then it turns out, you know, when as I'm leaving the courtroom, that these are guys that I went to elementary school with, junior high school with, that I went to church with, and who actually, you know, have participated in major events in my own life. And of course, it caused me to rethink any kind of simple binary between us and them, good and bad, as I already described. I mean, really, an awful and a horrific situation. My heart went out to his family, you know, as they're sitting there in court and people are describing, you know, sort of, you know, what is happening at stop three and stop four, and, you know, we got the rubber gloves on to touch him at this stop, and he seemed unresponsive at that stop, and, you know, I think that was just extraordinarily hard to take, and it caused me to also think about the way that this loss goes on. Very many people that I know have lost loved ones, people that they cared about, under unclear circumstances, either in police custody or at the moment of being apprehended by the police. And of course, you know, this is the really the genesis, I guess, of the Black Lives Matter movement. You know, I mean, just to stand up and say that people deserve better, American citizens deserve better care from the police forces than they are receiving.
I mean, one of the things that there's so much here in this piece that you wrote, and you go through a whole history of Baltimore and where we've come from, and you talk about the migration of your family, the families made from Sandtown, Winchester, up into Bentlow Street into Northwest Baltimore, and at a time when the Inner Harbor was being built, and you write about that, when Baltimore was 75% white and 900,000 people in the city. But I'd like you to paint this connection for me, the connection between that you wrote about, that history of what black Baltimore was under legal segregation, what happened to black Baltimore in the changes from the 75% white to 62% African American. And the fact that, you know, most likely the men that you met who are sheriffs in that courthouse, who are black men and a black woman, probably don't live in Sandtown, but live somewhere in Randallstown or Baltimore County,
sure,
or Northwest Baltimore, or Forest Park, or some other spot, or Howard Park, or wherever.
Right.
And so talk about what your thinking brings you to from this article about that situation.
Yeah, I mean, we are part of the thing that the article talks about, or maybe gestures towards, is that the condition of black people is a tradition of transition and movement, and one that has been nonstop and continues to go on. The 2010 census says that more than 50% of African Americans have returned to the American South. You know, I don't want to say that migration to the urban North was a complete failure, but, you know, you have the work of Isabel Wilkerson, The Warmth of Other Suns, you know,
great
sort of
book.
Wonderfully drawing out the reasons for the migration and also the trauma of resettlement, arguably. Or let me say it this way. You know, there are these marvelous moments in the Charles Dutton, David Simon, The Corner. And they have these couple moments of nostalgia on Monroe Street when young Gary is sort of back, it seems like the 1960s, and he's sort of walking down the street and everyone's sitting out front and, you know, having wonderful conversations and doo-wop on the corner. And Gary has a part-time job and he's, you know, destined to be a stockbroker. And I wonder if that nostalgia is genuinely merited. I wonder, Mark, if it was ever quite that rosy. And one of the things that that came out. I mean, certainly, many men in my neighborhood worked at Bethlehem Steel. I did not know what they did. You know, I mean, I assumed that they poured steel. You know what I mean? I didn't have a sense of like who's cleaning the latrine, who's sweeping up the metal shavings, who's pouring the hot stuff, and you know who's the manager, the rest of that. Apparently the steel jobs were never that abundant, and when they did get the jobs there, they were never that great. The people in my own family who worked there, I mean, I think that their lives were fairly tragic, for a whole range of reasons. But the movement for resources that would take you from, you know, sort of Park Heights, or I'm from Cold Spring or Wabash, that would take you from that part of the city to Woodlawn or to Pikesville or Owings Mills. I mean, it's just a very basic movement in the pursuit of better schools, in the pursuit of regular recreation, in the pursuit of anything that seems to be able to allow you not to get ahead, just to maintain and compete.
What hit me about the piece, especially the piece I just spoke to you about that I quoted from here, and I could quote a dozen other pieces if we had time, is this line, there's a demarcation that's not a permanent line. It's one that fades and gets lost for different reasons across a moment or across a year. But you have African-American sheriffs carting out another black man who is part of the family because he was mumbling and saying things to the – and there are three officers who were indicted. Three of them were black. Three of them were white. But that divide has become sharper in some ways since the end of segregation than it is in the 21st century.
The social class divide.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean there's something there. I mean, I think that because it's – when we look at Baltimore, it's 62%, 63%, whatever that real number is, African-American. And a plurality or majority of that of the black population in our city is poor. You know what I'm saying? So who are left behind after that time that you write about when people were moving to North Bentlow and out. And the steel mills may have been different for black than white workers, but, you know, like – my first wife's family were all steel workers out there, and it allowed them to buy the houses they wanted to buy in Northwest Baltimore and buy a house on Bentlow Street and do things they could never have done before, mm-hmm. right? Then that was taken away. So I'm just – it's the complexity of this moment is what I always think about. The article made me think about.
Mm. For me, on the refrigerator in my house in Atlanta, I have the outcome of a series of trials of public school educators.
Oh, yes, right.
Where I think it was 12 people were convicted of forging test scores. And it was another one of these striking occasions where you had, you know, sort of 12 middle-class African-Americans, more or less, it's about 12, been convicted of changing the scores. And for me, it's just a moment of the precariousness of black middle class life. The African American middle class is connected to the school system and it's connected to the post office and
Social Security Administration.
And the Social Security Administration. It's not connected to private industry, to private banking or
T. Rowe Price and
right, at all.
Exelon and right.
You know, I've heard some wonderful things about it's being able to be connected to Under Armour, right? So maybe Under Armour would be different.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, saying that to say that so the distance between living in subsidized public housing, living in low rent or subsidized rent areas, and owning a home in a all-black community with limited public services, and to owning a home or living in an area where there are more abundant resources, I feel like the distance maybe is not so great. So
right, I agree. I think that's true. We'll have a couple minutes left in the segment. We have to go to a tape segment here in a minute, and. Folks were calling in just about the trial itself. Mm. We don't have time for really a caller now because it's almost up against the clock. But we're going to come back to this early next week as well. So, and make your comments. And Mimi and Leo, we're always in the air taking your calls, and we'll be doing that in the coming week and more as we continue to look at all of this. And we want to get Larry Jackson here because of the piece he wrote, "The City That Bleeds: Freddie Gray and the Makings of an American Uprising," which I think it was a very powerful piece. In Harper's, that we will be linking to, tell me for yourself, for our listeners, as they go look for this piece in the next literally 2 minutes we have left. What is it you walked away with after you wrote this?
Boy, I want to say that I had some optimism from the meeting so many young people who are committed to trying to turn the situation around. Especially, I mean, just a little bit younger than me, but still a young person, especially a guy named Stokey Kennedy, who is putting together a human resources services center, a family services center in Sandtown, and also, you know, like I said, getting the chance really to interact with some of the students at the high school and to know that given the opportunity, they will make the transformation or are capable of making the transformation. But it's something that we also all have to be committed to.
I'm really happy you're coming back to Baltimore. This is very excited about that for us, for your students, and the fact that we can get you on the show a lot more sitting in the studio.
Love to come.
This is great having you back here. I'm sure Emery will miss you. But Dr. Lawrence Jackson, who will be moving to Johns Hopkins, a new book coming out about Chester Himes, in the coming year.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
So I'm glad to have him back in the city. And folks, we will link to this article. You want to read this article and really digest it. And we'll have Larry back here, especially when he gets back to the city, and have much more ranging and longer conversations with him. We're going to take a short break and come right back to a conversation that we taped with a woman named Ellen Siegel, who lived through the Sabra and Shatila massacres. Stay with us.